I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Orlando author and Rollins College alum Matt Rothschild is out with his debut book. It's a memoir called Dumbfounded, Big Money, Big Hair, Big Problems, or Why Having It All Isn't for Sissies. Rothschild grew up in the only Jewish family in a luxury Fifth Avenue apartment across from Central Park in New York City. He was raised by his grandparents and didn't really start having a relationship with his mother till well into his school years. Dumbfounded wades deep into Rothschild's dysfunctional family, his own confused sexual identity, and the legacy of relationships with caretakers that blur the lines between friend, antagonist, and parent. Tonight, Matt Rothschild speaks about his new book and how he went from a preppy East Coast rich kid to a writer and teacher in South Orlando. To join our conversation, call 1-866-338-5252 or send email to intersection@wmfe.org. The phone lines are open. And Matt Rothschild, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you very much.
It's really good to have you here. You know, you bring up a lot of difficult and painful memories in your memoir, and that must have been hard. So why did you write the book?
Well, I think that a lot of the reason why I started to write the book was to answer the lingering questions that I still had about my family and my relationship with my family. And I needed to do some serious soul searching. And so I sat down to write the only story that I knew how to write. And a lot of the things that happened in the book I realized over time, because I had grown so far beyond the actual events. So I write about a lot of things that happened when I was like 7 or 8 or in my teens.
What are some of those questions that you were wondering about?
Well, I found myself wondering about the reasons. Well, for instance, the reasons why my mother and my father chose to abandon me, and the actual, you know, how my grandparents felt about this. The reasons why my grandmother and her children didn't seem to get along, the reasons why my grandfather stayed so loyal to my mother despite everything that had happened.
And when you say abandoned, I mean, your grandparents did raise you. It wasn't quite like they left you on the street, right?
No, not at all. My grandparents raised me from one day old.
And when you go through that process of writing, did you think it was something necessary you had to do for yourself kind of as a person? Was it kind of cathartic?
I think that it probably was, although I don't think that I realized it at the time. And certainly I don't think that that was the reason why I sat down to do it. I think I sat down to do it because I knew that I wanted to write, and it was the only thing that I knew to write. It was the only story that I had to tell. And so I started to look at everything that I knew. They always say, write what you know, and I know myself.
So there was never a question for you of fiction versus nonfiction and that sort of thing?
I don't think that there was a true question of fiction versus nonfiction. I had tried my hand at fiction, and it just went terribly. But if I think about the various elements of my life, I think about like my grandfather, who was a man who had as much or just as much more money than his neighbors, but wouldn't get into a white Rolls Royce after Labor Day because he didn't want them to dislike him. Or I think about my friend Elaine, who shoplifted from FAO Schwartz even though she had enough money to buy and sell the place. Or I think about learning the exact moment when I learned that everything that I thought I knew in my life was a lie. And when you have material like that, you really don't seek to try to invent things.
How is it now for you as a writer here in Orlando, looking back at that lifestyle that you had as a child and looking at, I guess, the amount of resources one would assume comes with having that kind of wealth at your disposal?
Well, I think that it's obviously it's very different. It's very, very different. Even the logistics of living in New York versus the logistics of living in Orlando is extremely different. When I came to Orlando, I lived very well. I lived in Winter Park and I went to Rollins and I lived very well for a while. And then I moved from that lifestyle into a very different world. But I think that for a long time, I was really fueled by indignation, and I was really fueled by righteousness and self-righteousness and perhaps a little bit of self-importance. And so I didn't mind for quite a while. I think now, Now I live in College Park, but I live butted up right against the Paramore in College Park, and so I see disparity quite clearly.
When you put such a personal history into print, does that leave you feeling now vulnerable and exposed that all these people are able to read your book and learn pretty intimate stuff about yourself?
Oh, I should hope so. Well, I think that I think the greatest dichotomy about myself is that I'm a very private person, and that there are things in the book, which is basically everything, that I would never, ever tell another person. I wouldn't tell you. I wouldn't tell friends. I wouldn't tell people. I just wouldn't. But there, I will write about anything. I'll just write about everything.
How do you balance that out? Because surely some of this stuff, you've been talking to book reviewers and that sort of thing, must come back up. Is it hard to talk about?
Oh, yeah. I think I must have a personality disorder. In all seriousness, I think that when I was writing, certainly when I was writing, rather than to see myself as the character, or rather than to see myself doing all of these things, I thought about myself as the narrator, and I thought about people as being characters. And I found that the element of trying to remove me from the equation and seeing everybody as this kind of pastoral helped a lot.
1-866-338-5252 is the number to join our conversation. We're talking with Orlando author Matt Rothschild about his debut book called Dumbfounded. Now, this book is about your experiences as a child and your family, your relationship with them, about growing up. You were raised by your grandparents. Why did that happen? Why did your biological parents abandon you?
That's a good question. I think that you have to go back a little bit farther. My mother was about 20 years old when she became pregnant with me, and my mother and my father were married. My father was her second husband. And when she found out that she was pregnant with me, she had actually filed papers to be separated or divorced from my father. And so she had decided that she wanted to have her freedom. And part of course, wanting to be free of someone is difficult when you were raising the child. And she had voiced these concerns and some others to my grandparents. And she, I think, accidentally mentioned that she had considered the idea of abortion. And my grandparents told her that they would rather take me and raise me so that she could go off and do what she felt like she needed to do.
Is that a concept? It's got to be hard for you just to be able to accept and understand, especially as a young person.
As a young person, it was difficult, and I was the beneficiary of some very well orchestrated lies, and so I believed a lot of these things that they told about for instance, my grandmother told me that my mother had wanted me, but that she, my grandmother, had kind of like wrestled her for this baby, give me that baby, that kind of thing, right? And she had won out because, of course, you never messed with my grandmother. You give her whatever she wanted.
In the book, in your life, your grandmother was a huge, huge role model for you. Describe her for us.
My grandmother, let me think, I'm 5'8 and a half. My grandmother was slightly taller than me. She had kind of shoulder-length silver hair, the mouth of a truck driver. She had kind of that throaty, raspy voice. So people always assume that she was this smoker, even though she wasn't. She was like terrifically allergic to cigarette smoke, right? And she would frequently stop people on the street that she saw smoking and tell them just about, like, you know, that they were going to die and they were killing themselves, all this sort of stuff. And she, unafraid of anything, unapologetic about everything, and she said, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. Please leave it.
And what about your grandfather? How would you describe him?
My grandfather. You know, when I think about my grandfather, I love my grandfather. But I think about, do you remember in the 1990s when Coca-Cola did those advertisements with those very large cuddly polar bears, those big white polar bears? My grandfather was like one of those polar bears. He was just really wonderful and cuddly. He was European, so he spoke with a very dignified accent, and he was extremely cultured, but he was always looking for approval from other people, I think.
This book is, you know, about you as a young child growing up, dealing with your family that was dysfunctional, figuring out your sexual identity. And in this memoir vein, there are other writers that have kind of already
tread in those waters a little bit. David Sedaris a little bit.
He does.
The book Running with Scissors. So what makes this story more unique or different from those other types of stories?
Well, I think that all the stories are unique to some degree. My story is just that. It's my story. It's our own unique brand of family dysfunction. It's the environment. It's the Upper East Side. And I talked to some degree. We had this joke growing up about the Upper East Side syndrome and people who live in this world. And everybody in my book is groomed to be an insider, but nobody seems to fit in. And so it's an utterly familiar story, really, for anybody who has difficulty growing up, and for anyone who's searching for themselves, their place in their families, issues of identity. There are these issues of sexuality. There are these issues with, like, religious identity. There are these issues with class, with race, relationships, care for the elderly. And so the book itself, of course, is this myriad of really complex things with this mask of humor thrown all over it.
You know, as you grew up, to try to get attention for yourself, sometimes you'd kind of act out in school and would get the wrath of teachers. And that also led to a period when you were younger that you would impersonate your teachers at home. And this kind of led to an awkward moment between you and your grandparents. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading a passage about that from the book.
Oh, sure. Just to contextualize it, a friend of mine had dropped off this dress that she believed was something that our teacher, Miss Wood, would have worn. This was actually her maid's dress. And so it goes. I stopped, dumbfounded. My grandmother was at my bedroom door holding a stack of wadded papers. I recognized them immediately. Fortunately, the sight of me in a dress threw her off. What the hell are you doing? She asked. I glanced down at my dress. Playing school. Matthew, what are you wearing? A dress, I said. And where did you get this dress? I found it. My grandmother sighed. So you've been wandering around the women's department at JCPenney? Do you expect me to believe you couldn't find a better dress than that? Have I taught you nothing about style? I thought that it looked like Miss Wood, I said. Are you telling me that you're pretending to be that dumb broad? My grandmother looked down at her own Chanel shoes and remembered the papers in her hand. Oh, Matthew, what the hell are these? She asked, waving them around. I tried distracting her. Hey, do you like the pattern of the dress? No, I don't, and the driver found these under the seat of the car. Did he say whose they were? I asked, twirling the skirt. Matthew, how many third graders named Matthew Rothschild live in this house and ride home from school in our car? I don't understand. Why didn't you just show these to me? At this very moment, my grandfather walked into my bedroom and saw my outfit. His eyes widened. Sophie, the boy's wearing a dress. I can see he's wearing a dress, Howard, but that's not the problem. My grandfather stood silently, looking me up and down. Matthew decided to hide his homework assignments under the seat in the car rather than show them to us. That's our problem? He asked. He's in a dress and that's our problem? Will you forget about the dress a minute and look at the damn papers? My grandmother clearly had her priorities in order. Deception first, cross-dressing later. He took the papers and I winced. These are pretty good, he said. He started to laugh. The wrinkles around his eyes softened. Look at this one. Is this Moses? Yes, and those are the Hebrews, I said. Here he's leading them across the sea when he starts to get hungry for a fish, and... What are you doing, old man? Asked my grandmother, yanking the papers out of his hand. You don't ask him to expound on his artistic achievement right now. Stuffing homework under the seat of a car is not behavior you're supposed to encourage. Quite right, he said, growing serious again. Listen to your grandmother. Now why are you wearing this dress? I told him that I was playing school, and this was how my teacher dressed. But why are you pretending to be her? He asked. You'd rather him be Ava Gardner? Asked my grandmother. I don't know, I said. It's just a game. My grandmother said, Scrabble is a game, Matthew. This is role-playing.
So, I mean, is that like a typical encounter that happened in your family? And what were the ramifications following that?
I believe this particular event stood out a little bit. My grandfather went downstairs and hid in his study, which was kind of his refuge. My grandmother, I believe, tossed her hands up in the air and said, and couldn't understand why I wanted to dress like this dumb broad anyway. And I think that this was – I think that I was often in trouble actually at school, but not for things. I was in trouble for things at school, and this was something at home, and this was different. And obviously wearing this woman's dress, and then saying that you're doing this role playing where you're trying to be this woman, that's clearly bizarre.
And did that annoy them, aggravate them? What was their feeling did you get?
I think perplexity. I think they were just really like, what are you doing? And then, of course, once they realized it was once they got the answer, I mean, I think that was – I mean, I'm off in this way too. It's kind of like I can't move forward until I understand exactly why you've done this. And so it's like, well, why did you do that?
And at that time, was it just role-playing for you, or did it – was it on the cusp of figuring out sexual identity?
I think at that time it was – I think that it was simple role-playing. Not that role-playing is ever that simple, but I think that – and I talk about this to some degree in the book, that the women in my life all took on this role of mother, where I saw the concept of my mother as a character, right, even as a child, as being this really enigmatic figure that I didn't understand, that had kind of like gone off and done all of these really very, very luxurious, crazy, wonderful things, right? And I really sought the attention and the approval of basically all of the women in my life.
I'm talking with Orlando author Matt Rothschild about his debut book, Dumbfounded. We'll have more after a break.
I'm Aaron Henkin. Coming up on the story, Abigail Washburn loves China. She's lived there and learned the language, as she also happens to love the banjo. And one day, Abigail had a revelation.
The way the fingernail hits the string creates that poignant sound and then opens and resonates for a little while that honestly matches the monosyllabic nature of Chinese.
Mountain music in the People's Republic. That's the story. Please join me.
The Story with Aaron Henkin at 7 p.m. on Member Support at 90.7 WMFE.
Thank you to Deborah and David Auerbach and Jane Stonemetz, members of the Cornerstone Society at the Keystone level of giving, special donors annually supporting the programs you enjoy on WMFE. If you're interested in becoming a Cornerstone Society member, visit WMFE.org.
And you're tuned to member-supported public radio, 90.7 WMFE-FM Orlando, NPR News, and classical music.
This is Intersection. I'm Mark Simpson. Tonight I'm speaking with Orlando author Matt Rothschild about his debut book, Dumbfounded. It's the story of him growing up in a privileged lifestyle on the Upper East Side of New York City and how Rothschild negotiated the jagged relationships within his family. And you can join our conversation by calling 1-866-338-5252, or if you're online, you can send email to intersection@wmfe.org. Matt Rothschild, how did you go from being this Upper East Side rich kid in New York City to a teacher and a writer down in Orlando, Florida?
I came down to Orlando in 1999 as a way to upset my mother. After I had essentially left where I was living outside of the Boston Common. I had left all of that. My grandmother and I were living in Boston because I was going to school up there. And I came down. I knew some people, some friends from school, from boarding school, who were coming to Rollins. And so I tagged along because I had really nothing else to do. And I figured you have to go somewhere. And so I came here and stayed for a few years. And I needed something to do after I graduated. And I thought that I would teach for a little while because teaching contracts are about a year long, and I knew that I wanted to work for a year.
In terms of the choice of actually coming to Orlando, I mean, you had a wide variety of schools you could have gone to, great schools in the country in the Northeast. Was it just a factor of distance, trying to separate yourself a little bit from the family?
It wasn't. The last real wish my grandmother expressed was that she wanted me to get as far away from my family as possible. And you're right, I did have lots of offers, and actually I did attend another school first, but then I left that school and I found myself here.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Nick, who's calling in from downtown Orlando. Good evening, Nick. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to start by saying I've only read a few chapters of the book, but the story is extraordinary, and I just can't even put it down, so thank you for writing it, Matt.
Oh, thank you for reading it.
But I did have one quick question. Obviously, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it is quite a difficult story that you're telling, and I was wondering whether or not you consider yourself a humorist as a writer, and why you chose humor to tell the story.
I think that it's good. That's a really good question. Yeah, I do. I do consider myself to be a humorist. And I try to weigh the fact that my first love is comedy and humor with the idea that I know that I have some heavier issues to talk about. And I think that if you write a story like mine, or so many other stories as well, they can be these really intense tomes. And when you write them straight, when you write them plain, oftentimes you can really turn readers off. You can really turn the audience off because that level of cerebral activity is just something that we don't really seek out. But when you do things through humor, people get the message, but they get the message subtly. And I think that that's it certainly is a much better way for me to talk about these issues.
1-866-338-5252 is the number if you'd like to join our conversation, or you can send email to intersection@wmfe.org. What stands out for you as the biggest differences between living that kind of East Coast lifestyle and coming down here and living in Florida?
Oh, I mean, if you're talking about like the lifestyle that I lived before, I mean, it's night and day. I mean, I grew up in a 19-room duplex on Manhattan's Upper East Side. You looked out the window, you saw the sun setting over Central Park, over like the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We never had any less than 2 full-time live-in servants in our house, and though we were really very nice to them, it's this whole idea. Of course, you know, now. Now it's very, very different. Now it's extremely different. I mean, I have to like make the coffee myself.
Was it small things like that that were hard to get used to?
No, I think not, because by the time I really got used to those things, you have to remember, like, when I walked away from all of that, when I walked away from that lifestyle, I was really fueled by the idea that I was doing the right thing, and that kept me going for a really long time. And by the time the details came around, it just all came out in the wash.
Do you like Orlando? Do you like Central Florida?
Yeah, I do. Orlando, I have to tell you, Rollins and Orlando have given me opportunities that I don't think that I would have had otherwise because of the size of the school. It was around all of these really supportive professors who taught me so many wonderful things and gave me this opportunity to grow. And in Orlando, there was a lot of opportunity to shine as well.
Has anything of the culture in Central Florida rubbed off on you, changed you at all?
Oh, definitely. I would have to imagine that it has, because in Orlando, the number one industry, we have the travel, we have the tourism, all of the restaurants are chain restaurants. There's very few independents. And so, of course, my views on customer service, for instance, are often like directed by the norms at, say, like the Starbucks or something else. It's interesting.
Now, you live in the Paramore neighborhood, or right on the edge of it.
Yes.
In Orlando. Talk about living there, and how do you intake that perspective, I guess, after what you've already come through?
Oh, it's delicious. I can't even begin to properly like describe it. I moved into this area because the house that I live in I live in an apartment, but it's a converted house. So it was built like in the 1940s, and the owner refurbished all of the units and made them into apartments. And so this friend of mine and I, a couple summers when I moved in, did all of this work on it or whatnot. And so, of course, what's interesting to me is that I like directly behind me is the Paramore, and the noise of the Paramore and the life of the Paramore and the culture of the Paramore. And it's very interesting, extremely interesting, and very diverse.
What stands out for you?
The noise.
What is that noise of? What is the sound?
The sounds are generally, it's interesting. It's actually, it's a lot of anger, obviously. It's a lot of anger, and it's a lot of frustration, and it's a lot of aggression, and it's very interesting because on this one side you have the Paramore, and on the other side you are moving closer and closer to Lake Adair, and so you are basically every block you're going up exponentially in terms of like housing prices.
What else stands for you out in that neighborhood, and do you prefer living where you are now to when you were living in Winter Park, and for what reasons?
I like College Park a fair bit. I think that College Park for me is better than Winter Park. Like, I like Winter Park because I think that it's very scenic and whatnot. But of course, Winter Park tends to take itself very seriously at times. And College Park is still—it's a little bit younger. It's a little bit it's still a little bit like up and coming, and Winter Park is very established.
You also were a teacher in Orlando at a local high school,
yes.
But you are no longer teaching there.
That is correct. This last academic year was my last year teaching.
What experiences did you have as a teacher, and how did that kind of change you and change your view on things?
Well, I mean, I think that it's important to remember that my experience as a teacher and my experience as like a high school student were completely night and day. I went to New England boarding school, prep school, et cetera, a very Dead Poet Society, right, without the inspirational teacher. And and I came, it was very much like Catcher in the Rye, actually. And then I came to Orlando and to this particular school. And so you go from having like vocabulary words like anachronistic or assiduous, and you go into having vocabulary words in this new school to having like prophylactic and chlamydia.
But you were an English teacher and a reading teacher. What challenges did you see day to day, and how did that just impact your life?
I think the first challenge that I had, and it actually continued to be a challenge the entire time, was how to properly and effectively motivate students who are not motivated by traditional means.
Sort of like yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Except, of course, it's obviously very different because when you, and I'm thinking about particular students, when you are worried about where your next meal is coming from or your home life or where you're sleeping that particular night, it's very different than being simply like, you know, feeling somewhat neglected by your very wealthy and elusive mother.
Do you think you were able to make an impact?
I think I was able to make an impact because I like to listen when people talk, and I like to really understand people and get to know them, and I like to help. I really like to help people. And so it became more important to me to help people than it became important to me to teach the Shakespeare.
Were you able to write this book and maintain your teaching career at the same time?
Actually, I started out writing about like a chapter a week when I first started teaching. I rewrote the book probably at least like half a dozen times over the course of the years I was there.
Was it hard to be able to balance that, or was it good to have a kind of a motivational goal that you were working on?
It was good to have that, to have all of the things that were going on at school, because it fueled my creativity. But I will tell you that I never felt good about both things at the same time. I either felt like the teaching was suffering, or I felt like my writing was suffering.
So the book is out now. What's next for you?
Right now I am working with a friend on a screenplay, and I'm putting together notes for another memoir. So I'll start working on that in the fall.
Where would it take us, do you think? Beyond Dumbfounded?
Oh, yes. Beyond Dumbfounded. I don't really have too much intention of continuing to write about my family. I have something of a visceral reaction when it comes to resuscitating the dead for a paycheck. I think I'm more interested in my teaching life, obviously, and the things, the lessons that I learned, and the hilarity that's there. And I'm also really interested in exploring adult relationships.
Matt Rothschild is an Orlando author and Rollins College alumni, and has taught in Orlando's public school system. Matt, thanks for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you very much.
Sheena Carlisle is our technical director. Lisa Phillips handles the phones. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. To get our weekly podcast, visit our website, wmfe.org/intersection, and click on the link that says podcast. Coming up on 90.7, stay tuned for the story with Dick Gordon. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.